That's when he did this ad campaign in New York Times, among others. He put in one of the justifications for the dams were that people could ride motorboats to look at the Grand Canyon. And he said, maybe we should flood the Sistine Chapel so people could see Michelangelo's paintings better. And that was in New York Times, and it really changed the discussion. Most people wouldn't be able to think of a campaign like that. And what Duck said, the smart businesses and smart environmental groups are wise to keep the people on there that help start these organizations and on their staff that were passionate about these topics and that are knowledgeable, and that they give them the freedom to continue to do the passionate things they care about. And if you got to get a bean counter, get a bean counter, but not one that can keep the passionate, wise person from articulating what the mission and the goals of the organization are.
You're listening to the Rewilding Earth Podcast. George Werthner is a professional photographer, writer, and ecologist. He's visited hundreds of mountain ranges around the West, more than 400 wilderness areas, more than 200 national park units, and every national forest west of the Mississippi. George is the author of 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, A Century of Failed Forest Policy, Energy, The Delusion of Endless Growth and Overdevelopment, Thrillcraft, and Keeping the Wild. His most recent publication is Protecting the Wild. Jonathan Ratner has extensive knowledge of federal land management agency methods and practice, with a specialty in public lands livestock grazing. He's been monitoring and commenting on grazing cases in Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado for the last 20 years. Prior to that, he studied endangered species such as the grizzly bear, lynx, wolverine, and marten for the Interagency Grizzly Bear Study Team, the U.S. Forest Service, and the Bureau of Land Management. Join us today for a great discussion about who funds conservation, how small groups can seek alternate funding and avoid mission creep or derailment, and also an exciting announcement from Jonathan and George.
Jonathan and George, thanks so much for agreeing to be on the Rewilding Earth podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks much for having us.
So I want to know more about Sage Step Wild. You have an announcement to make, and so I wanted to tease that as well. But let's start with Sage Step and what the organization is all about.
Yeah, I've been working in public lands management issues for the last quarter of a century, and fairly recently felt the need for an organization that was like completely focused on public lands and public lands wildlife protection, that was not moving in the direction of what I see frequently of a emphasis on human needs. I'm looking for a complete focus on what the land needs, what the planet needs, what everything else but humans need, as opposed to like how humans can benefit from conservation action X or Y. And I felt the need, as more and more organizations go into that direction of the anthropocentric worldview, that there was needed to be an organization that was really focused on the biocentric issues as opposed to the human-centric.
And I would add that the name, Sage Step, indicates our sort of emphasis area, which would be from the Cascades all the way through the Rockies to the Great Plains. That's where you have the abundance of sagebrush, which is one of the largest plant community types in the West. And it goes all the way up to high elevations. You can find sagebrush at 10,000 feet, and you can find it at elevations of less than 1,000 feet. And it's an ecosystem that is largely ignored by a lot of conservation groups as well, because they focus on things like old growth forests. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but the focus on the less forested ecosystems of the West, they've basically been neglected.
So what's the difference actually between the sage steppe and the landscape, the region covered by like American Prairie Reserve? Are we talking some overlap there in the kind of ecology?
Yeah, I always put it as like much of the 11 arid Western states. And like the area I cover goes beyond specifically just sagebrush up into forested situations into California. I'm dealing with a situation on the Modoc National Forest at the moment, but generally where the vast majority of public lands exists, setting aside Alaska.
Has our fundraising success and failure in certain areas shaped the way some public lands are treated versus others? Just because maybe it's hard to raise money for things that don't have a great big charismatic megafauna presence, or am I being too cynical?
No, I don't think you're being too cynical at all. Yeah, I have definitely noticed a, particularly over the last, say, 10 to 15 years, a significant focus on marketing as opposed to conservation. And I think how the shift to anthropocentric conservation occurred was the growth of these big funders, and I won't probably name them specifically, but essentially the rise in the big tech and oil funders that essentially underwrite much of North American conservation at this point. In their sort of focus groups, they considered, you know, that it wasn't very popular with the American people to protect land for land's sake. It had to be for like what humans could get out of it. So recreation and like having people in all their pictures and making it human-centric. And that shift has just dramatically picked up over the last 15 to 20 years. And how I differentiate Sagestep Wild is we're not interested in like marketing. We're interested in getting things done. And we're not afraid to take positions that may not be popular with the sort of mainstream conservation community. And that's how I see us being significantly different than the sort of mainstream situation.
I have my own little nonprofit called Public Lands Media, but my motto for it is the Lorax. I speak for the trees, which is how I see this differentiation, trying to give voice to plants and animals and ecosystems that maybe are not represented well or at all in the political discussions. I was in graduate school in the University of Oregon years ago in Eugene, and I was in geography program, but I took a class in environmental studies and a graduate class, and there were 13 other students. And somehow we got onto the topic of Sea Shepherd and Paul Watson trying to stop Japanese whaling. And to my surprise, all 13 environmental studies students said that they supported Japanese whaling because it was part of their cultural traditions.
Oh, yeah.
And I tried to bring up whales are rare, they're important for ecosystems. None of that, of those arguments won them over. They said Japanese have been whaling for years. Of course, the technology has changed greatly, but that didn't matter. And they all agreed that Paul Watson was an evil guy for trying to stop whaling by Japanese whalers. And so that was my first inference. You know, I was totally unaware of this shift that was happening. And since that time, particularly in academic circles in the humanities, which environmental studies programs usually are, and anthropology and political science and those kind of disciplines, there has been a real trend towards questioning anything as far as conservation in general. Conservation is being characterized as colonialism and negative terms like that. And that never considers what the effects of conservation are for all these other species that may benefit from, say, having a national park or a wilderness area. And so anyway, I've seen that grow tremendously in the last couple of decades. And now a lot of conservation groups have adopted that same philosophy in many cases. There are groups out there, I'll give you one example, the Montana Wilderness Association changed its name to Wild Montana because it didn't want to have the word wilderness in its name anymore, because that's considered a bad thing to affect wilderness, I guess. So, and of course, I don't agree with that. And so that's one of the shits. Jonathan, you got any stories to tell that way?
Oh, yeah. Probably the biggest thing I run into and have run into ever since I started a quarter of a century ago is, you know, the issue of livestock grazing on public lands. The situation is that the sort of mainstream conservation organizations both don't understand sort of basic ecosystem function and refuse to deal with the politics involved in it. They just say, oh, no, it's too toxic politically. we're not going to deal with it. And a lot of it has to do with who their funders are. When your funder is, oh, what's her name? The calculator heiress who has the big ranch in Idaho, whose name I'm forgetting.
Yes, I'm forgetting it too. Yeah. I know. That's
yeah. So, HP. So she's a major funder of conservation organizations, but requires them to not mention anything about livestock grazing. And if you know, if you spend any time understanding the ecosystem of the arid West, you understand that basically, you know, like this ecosystem did not evolve with large herbivores and cannot withstand heavy concentrations of large herbivores. And so there's really a major dichotomy throughout much of the arid West between functional ecosystems and livestock production. You can't have both at the same time. And like the number of entities that are willing to admit that and work on those issues is vanishingly small.
And to elaborate further on what complicates it is as these groups get larger, and there tends to be a relationship between the more employees a group has to how afraid they are to take on any kind of issues that are controversial. But one of the results of that is as they have more employees, the fundraising becomes more critical. And what I've seen, particularly in Western organizations, is that it becomes then important to get a number of people on your board who can write big paychecks to the organization. And if you go around the West, what do wealthy people do with their money? They buy ranches. And so you wind up getting people on your board then that own a ranch, say, in Jackson Hole or someplace in Montana or whatever. And then they have a big influence on the issues that organization will deal with because you can't afford to lose your big donor or two. And that's how it influences what the organizations do as far as their strategies and the issues that they take on. Let me give you another explanation of how this happens, because I've been on probably 10 or 12 boards around during my life. And what I have seen on some organizations is this. You, first of all, most organizations start out with somebody who has some kind of passion about the subject, like Jonathan. That's how they get started. And or like the Center for Biodiversity is another good one, you know, and Peter and those guys were working basically for nothing for the Forest Service and got interested in Mexican spotted owls. And so they started the center. So what you find out is that these organizations start out with passionate people. But then over time, as they grow in a lot of cases, and you have to really fight this, you wind up having the need for more and more money, as I said. And then what happens is whoever is the passionate person that helped start the organization, a lot of times they're not particularly maybe good at running the organization. They're not necessarily good at fundraising or whatever. So then they get either replaced or they retire. And then the board at that point starts looking around for somebody else to be the executive director. And by then, fundraising becomes more important. And then what I've seen over and over again, you get a new executive director that may know nothing about the mission subject matter of the organization. I'll just use livestock raising as an example. If you had an organization dealing with that, you get a new executive director who maybe used to be a fundraiser for hospitals or something. They may be sympathetic to the idea of trying to do something about livestock raising, but they're not really knowledgeable. So then their executive director, they start hiring more staff. The staff, because the executive director doesn't really understand the topic very much, they're more interested in just getting staff that have nice credentials, went to a fancy university or have a law degree or whatever. Again, that doesn't mean you can't learn these topics, but it helps a lot if you get somebody who is shown by their passion to be dealing with these issues over the years, even when they weren't getting paid. And that transition goes on to the point then where the board members tend to be, particularly a lot of these organizations there, you recruit board members. So then you have the people that own ranches or sympathetic to ranching. I'm again using this as an example, but it could be any topic. They recruit other people that have an interest in that, have the money, but also tend to be maybe aligned with the ranching industry just because they have the money to buy a ranch. So you see this change in the organization over time, and it's difficult to prevent And it takes a lot of looking at the topic. One of the organizations I'm a board member for is Restore the North Woods in New England. And John Davis, by the way, is on the board. But we have had one of our main things when we're recruiting a board member is we want somebody who has a real understanding of what our mission is and our goal of protecting lands in New England as wildlands. And if they don't, we've had people we've interviewed and possibly considered, they didn't know the difference between Forest Service or National Parks or whatever. They didn't get on the board because we just felt like we would spend too much time explaining what we're trying to do. And anyway, that's what happens over time with a lot of organizations.
The problem remains then for, I'm sure, Sage Step Wild and the other organizations we're all associated with. This is a loaded question. I already know the answer intimately, unfortunately. It leaves us working with fringe donors, like people who are as rebellious with their money as those who run these organizations are in sticking to their guns. And those people are few and far between. We often find ourselves fighting over that same pile of money. What kind of revelation have you guys had with Sage Step Wild or other organizations? I'm dying to hear. And I know a lot of other people who work with organizations listen to this podcast would love to hear too.
My experience, I was lucky. I worked for a while for Doug Tompkins, who was one of those people who did look outside of the box and had sufficient resources to support organizations and campaigns that others would avoid. But you're absolutely right. The Doug Tompkins of the world are very rare. And even Doug had to go through an evolution and an aha moment where in the late 80s, he decided that being a business person with the main goal of just earning millions of dollars just wasn't satisfying. And he felt like it was harming the planet as well. And you just don't get that. We used to fantasize that Doug, some people thought he was pretty wealthy, but relative to somebody like Bill Gates, he didn't have any money at all in a relative sort of way. We used to fantasize, how can we get Bill Gates or somebody like that to care about wildland? Bill Gates could fund most of the organizations in the West. That's the problem, is the focus of people like that is usually on human issues if they're interested in all doing any kind of good philanthropy at all.
You're listening to the Rewilding Earth podcast. Did you know we also publish insightful and inspirational content from leading rewilding scholars, poets, artists, and organizers from around the world? You can visit rewilding.org and sign up for our weekly digest to receive brilliant, fresh insights on everything rewilding. You'll find over a decade of articles and news from the front lines of wildlands protection and all kinds of restoration efforts. Check us out at rewilding.org and don't forget to share it with friends.
There's another question to Jonathan in terms of bringing in new people and engaging new people and having that education happen where there's a possibility in the future of having nature as part of the discourse when someone's talking about the anthropocentric issues. It's so easily, in my view, so easily left out because the ecological education of the average American is in the sewer. It's so low. How do you do this and also attract new people to these issues that you know they're not talking about in mass?
That's a good question. And I have biases based on my experience. So like I started working for Western Watersheds Project, John Marvel, back in the early days of the Western Watershed Project. And his philosophy was that like the idea of educating the general public so they care is a task that is not one of ease. And his essential philosophy in terms of connecting and fundraising and things like that was just focus on the few people who don't need a significant amount of attention to get to the point where they understand the issues, because the idea of a small group of 10 or 12 people changing the national understanding of what public lands are and what they could be is just too difficult a task to deal with. And so I've inherited John Marvel's position that you got to deal with the people who already care, and that you can't spend a huge amount of your energy and attention on educating the general population. That's essentially where I'm at. I have a strong focus on dealing with the federal agencies with certain exceptions, but that's where my attention is, and not on the public outreach, because As you said, the level of understanding of ecosystem processes or even what public lands are was incredibly low in throughout the American population. I remember years ago having interns, and they thought that when these were sort of conservation folks, like beginning conservation folks, you know, that they thought BLM was a national park and things like that. And yeah, my attention is focused really tightly on the agencies themselves who are doing the destruction, and not a lot on the sort of public education side of the picture.
I tell you, and one more story. When I first met Doug Tompkins, I got invited to his house when he was still living in San Francisco for a meeting, which resulted in the creation of the Wildlands Project, which is now called the Wildlands Network. But at the time of that, he told a story about how he, as a business person, he saw a lot of businesses that were started. He made the analogy that conservation groups were like businesses in the same sense that they're usually started by somebody who has a new way to make a better mousetrap or has some passion about something. And eventually the business expands. And then especially if it gets a board of directors, a lot of times they start to be more focused on payoff to the stockholders. And they get rid of this person who was a genius for thinking of new ways and thinking out of the box. And a lot of times that leads to this, you know, stagnation of the company. And he said, I see the same thing happening in a lot of environmental organizations. And he used the analogy of how the Sierra Club got rid of David Brower, who for a variety of reasons, people felt wasn't very good at organizing and using money, but he was a genius to promoting and taking on issues that people thought were hopeless. A good example is when he stopped dams in the Colorado River. Those dams were within Grand Canyon National Park, and they were supported by the Secretary of Interior, the senators and congressmen from the states around there, Arizona, California, Nevada, et cetera, and plus the people, proponents of hydro and irrigation. You couldn't have more people lined up against you than that. And that's when he did this ad campaign in New York Times, among others. He put in one of the justifications for the dams were that people could ride motorboats to look at the Grand Canyon. And he said, maybe we should flood the Sistine Chapel so people could see Michelangelo's paintings better. And that was in New York Times, and it really changed the discussion. Most people wouldn't be able to think of a campaign like that. And what Doug said, the smart businesses and smart environmental groups are wise to keep the people on there that help start these organizations and on their staff that were passionate about these topics and that were knowledgeable, and that they give them the freedom to continue to do the passionate things they care about. And if you got to get a bean counter, but not one that can keep the passionate, wise person from articulating what the mission and the goals of the organization are.
I would add a bigger picture comment in terms of United States conservation. When you go back, say, 40 years ago or 50 years ago, the funding stream for conservation, while small, was highly diverse. It was not dominated by, as it is now, by essentially four foundations. And because back then it was a very diverse ecosystem of funding, there wasn't, the funders did not maintain such an extreme level of control as they do now. And so these essentially four major funders have consolidated the sort of funding ecosystem and the strings that are attached to that funding, where anything that they don't want talked about is not talked about. Or spin that they want out there is spin that gets out there. And so things like the foundational issues of human population and its livestock are not popular with the funders, and therefore you can't talk about them. And like George and I have talked about the pushback on these kinds of issues before, and I have an actual mathematical formula, which is not popular, but it actually boils down pretty much everything. I equals P times T times E. So I equals impact, like human impact, equals population times tools available to that population times the energy available to drive those tools. And if examine that and you compare that to the common understanding that is put out by the funders and then through the fundees that we can have our cake and eat it too. Like we can have 9 billion people and like current usage, and all we need to do is drive a Prius, which doesn't make any logical physical sense. But if you bring that up, you definitely will not get funding from any of these funders.
I think you've painted a pretty clear picture here today of the kinds of things that groups like ours are up against. And it's not easy.
I would like to elaborate on that with an analogy. One of the things that we try to promote is the idea of biodiversity preservation. In other words, in ecosystems, the more different species you have out there, the less reliant that ecosystem becomes on one or two factors to drive it. And then there's repetition of what species will do that help to make the ecosystem more stable and able to survive severe disturbances. And in a way, the funding ecosystem, getting back to what Jonathan was saying, is like that. If you have a lot of different donors, you're not under the same pressure. If somebody disagrees with it, you can try to explain to them why it might be important. But eventually you could even just say, we're going to deal with it. And if you don't like it, we're sorry. And I, for many years before I worked for Doug Tompkins, I was a freelance writer. And I ran into this all the time with some of the issues. I would particularly was interested in livestock grazing on public lands. And I had any number of magazines and publishers that I used to do work for blackball me and no longer would buy my articles or have me write articles or buy my photographs because they didn't like the things I was saying about livestock raising. The fortunate thing was I was like the small groups in that I had many sources of income streams from all sorts of things that I was doing that I could survive even without maybe some of those organizations' support. But that is the problem with having everything into just a couple of major funders. When I was in college, I focused on ecology classes primarily, but I did wind up taking 3 economics classes. And what I found was of interest to me is that a lot of the basic principles of economics are also reflected by ecology, which was an aha moment for me. In other words, if you're looking at the economics of something, you have a cost benefit. If you're a species, you have cost benefits you have to consider. Is it good to be an elk out in the open feeding where the best grass is, but that's also where the wolves can run you down quickly? So maybe you graze more in the timber where the vegetation isn't quite as good, but you're less likely to get killed by a wolf. So that's a cost-benefit analysis. And it's just the same sort of things in a lot of ways we see in economics. And I think that ecology helps you to develop a way of understanding maybe the political and economic systems that we're dealing with.
I teased earlier that you guys had an announcement. Would you like to talk about that now?
As part of the creation of Sage Step Wild, I was looking around of projects that I had my eye on for a long time, needing some attention. And one of them was the Wildlife News. And it, at its peak, it was a significant news source for all things sort of wildlife, public lands management related, and had a significant following both in the Western United States as well as particularly in the Washington, D.C. Beltway. And over the last, say 7 or 8 years, the attention on it had declined due to the founder was getting up there in years and was not able to put the attention it needed on it. And we contacted the creator of the Wildlife News, Ralph Maughan, and he was happy to turn it over to Sage Step Wild. And so now it is a project under Sage Step Wild. And we will be re-enlivening it over the next little bit and getting additional authors and all that kind of stuff so that it will hopefully surpass its previous peak and really be a significant news source for the important issues facing our public lands and wildlife.
So that's thewildlifenews.com. And I know we also have listeners who are authors and writers, and take note. There's not a new outlet in town, but it's under new management. And I'm sure that most of those people know exactly who the Wildlife News is and count on it as a source of really great, credible information in our world. So it's really good to hear that you guys are taking this up and the website's getting a new look, and that we still are going to have this outlet. Nobody at Rewilding would like to see the wildlife news disappear. So this is really great news.
Yeah. And those who, you know, like our authors and would like to post from time to time, definitely get in touch. We would love to have a broader stable of authors contributing.
They would want to contact us through the Sage Step Wild.
Correct.
Okay. That's wild-sage.org. Wild-sage.org. So that's the place to go. That's great. And I can't wait to see what the new website looks like. What are you guys looking forward to? You guys are not new to this world. Why do you get out of bed in the morning? And what is it that continually gets you out of bed in the morning?
Wow, that is a difficult question. Right now, I'm in the middle of this nightmare of the Bears Ears National Monument Resource Management Plan. And I must say, the irritation of the corruption within the BLM in this case, it definitely gets me up out of the bed in the morning, because it is breathtaking when you have a situation where they're, and probably most listeners are familiar with the sort of ping pong ball going back and forth on a Bears Ears National Monument, designation string of RMPs, etc. I must say the proposed one that they have out for comment right now is, like, setting aside the fact that the Trump era one reduced the size, but it is significantly worse in most ways from the Trump one, and is worse than even the Bush 2 era RMP that was developed under the multiple use framework. And yeah, that gets me up out of bed in the morning.
And I get up a lot of ways. I'm motivated by trying, as I mentioned earlier at the beginning, providing a voice for the voiceless out there. In other words, the natural world. And trying to provide a perspective that you may not hear very often. And I try to suggest that I do a lot of writing and commentary and stuff that I send to newspapers and other places. And my goal is to try to provide a perspective that maybe is not commonly articulated and based on, or I might say, ecologically informed, to try to bring that perspective to people that might not otherwise understand. A good example is I've written for years and studied for years wildfires, and the usual way that wildfires are portrayed is that it's a disaster for the ecosystem. And one of the unknown factors is that actually the snag forests that survive a major wildfire are ecologically important. And in fact, they are a rarer ecosystem than, say, old growth forests and other things that we seek to preserve. So from an evolutionary and ecological protection ecosystem function, we have to, in a sense, look at fires that create snag forests as a gift, because they help to keep the ecosystem functioning. So that's a kind of to say that a lot of species are afraid of green forests. That's contrary to what everybody thinks. And I'm trying to change that perspective so that there's a tolerance for things like large wildfires in the West and protecting things like predators like wolves, or giving consideration to why we might want to keep sage grouse and sage brush ecosystems functioning and so forth. So that's what I get up for.
And one thing I would like to add is, as part of the kickoff of the organization, George, myself, and a number of other experts in Western ecosystem function will be putting on a training in Northern Nevada towards the end of May. And basically, the focus will be on training folks who are interested in how to be more effective. And as part of that, being able to understand and quantify how the ecosystems function. And anyone who's interested in gaining a better understanding of, like, how to interact with the federal agencies, as well as how the ecosystems function across the Western United States, are certainly welcome. If you just go to the wild-sage.org website and go to the menu that says training, you can get some details on that page.
And at rewilding.org/POD, episode 123, We're going to, Jonathan and George are going to give me all kinds of little resources for our extra credit section. So just look for episode 123 anywhere, actually not anywhere. You have to go to rewilding.org/POD. It won't be where you're listening to this podcast necessarily. But I just want to thank you guys. I feel very lucky that you two are out in the wild and doing what you do and are so intensely passionate about it after careers, which would nobody would blame you for getting burnout. Nobody would blame you for disappearing after all the immense amount of work that you've done when you've said, this is enough. And you're still just going. You're so inspirational. I watch you very closely. And I really appreciate you, as I know everyone here at Rewilding and all of our supporters do as well. So thank you very much. And thanks for taking the time being here today.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Rewilding Earth podcast. We do what we do because of you. This podcast is supported by listeners like you who long to live in a wilder world. Please consider donating at rewilding.org and subscribe to our weekly news and article digest while you're there. To go the extra mile, you can follow and share Rewilding Earth on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Bonus points for sharing this podcast with your friends. To listen to past episodes, go to rewilding.org/pod. That's rewilding.org/POD.